Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. Today, we have a moderated discussion on Food and Drug Administration versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, in which the Supreme Court issued a 9-0 decision on June 13th, 2024. It is my honor to introduce our moderator and our guests today. Our moderator is Professor Teresa Stanton Collette. Teresa is a professor and the director of the Pro-Life Center at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. Our first guest is Adam Unikowski. Adam is a partner at Jenner & Block, LLP. Our second guest is Megan Wold. Megan is a partner at Cooper & Kirk. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to our moderator to give us the background of the case.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be a part of this program and excited to hear what our panelists have to say. We're discussing a case that I believe has been widely, in some ways, misreported in the press, in part because it turns on what some have been calling a legal technicality. And so rather than take up time with my comments on it, I will turn to our panelists who have some opening statements to sort of explain how they read the case itself. Adam?
Thank you for that introduction. So I'll probably just talk for a couple of minutes. I'll begin by summarizing what the case was, what the Supreme Court held, and what the implications of the ruling are. And then I'll very briefly editorialize a little bit about what I think about the ruling, which is maybe the more interesting part. So most of you know what the case is about, but for those who don't, the plaintiffs are organizations of pro-life doctors, as well as a few individual pro-life doctors. They filed a lawsuit in the Northern District of Texas, alleging that the FDA had acted illegally in approving mifepristone, which is a drug that causes abortions, in 2000, and alternatively arguing that the FDA acted illegally in loosening certain conditions of use through a series of orders in 2016, 19, and 21. And the plaintiffs, of course, to establish their entitlement to any relief at all, must have Article III standing. And so the plaintiffs are doctors that they do not prescribe mifepristone themselves. They're not required to, and they never allege that they did, in fact, prescribe it. Their theory of standing was a little bit different. Essentially, their theory of standing turned on injuries that would result if other doctors prescribe mifepristone. The theory was that if other doctors would do that, then patients would have complications and then come to emergency rooms and encounter the plaintiff doctors, whereupon the plaintiff doctors either would experience a conscience violation or would simply be expending resources on caring for the patients that they'd rather expend in a different way. And the plaintiff organizations also alleged that they had to spend time and money essentially educating people as to the harms of mifepristone, which they wouldn't have had to do if mifepristone hadn't been approved. So a federal district court in Texas agreed with the plaintiff's arguments on both standing and the merits and held that the FDA had acted illegally in approving mifepristone back in 2000 and essentially granted complete victory to the plaintiffs. After some flurry of filings, both in the Fifth Circuit and in the Supreme Court, that order was stayed in its entirety, so it never actually went into effect as a result of the Supreme Court's order. Ultimately, the Fifth Circuit partially affirmed the district court as relevant to the Supreme Court's ruling. The court held that the plaintiffs did have standing, which is what opened up the door for them to obtain relief on other issues. And the Fifth Circuit ultimately concluded that the district court was correct to hold that the FDA acted illegally with respect to certain decisions in 2016 and 2021, loosening conditions of use. But the Fifth Circuit disagreed with the district court's assessments with regard to the initial approval in 2000. So in the Supreme Court, the parties litigated both the standing issue, which the plaintiffs had prevailed on in the Fifth Circuit, as well as the merits issue that the plaintiffs had prevailed on. The Supreme Court declined to hear the plaintiffs' cross-challenge to the issues on which the plaintiffs lost on in the Fifth Circuit. And the Supreme Court ultimately ruled that the plaintiffs did not have Article III standing in a unanimous decision by Justice Kavanaugh. So the court walked through the three theories of standing that the plaintiffs had proffered and concluded that each of them was inadequate. So first of all, the plaintiffs alleged a conscience violation that they might experience either if they had to perform an abortion or perhaps provide medical care to someone who had complications from a mifepristone abortion. And the Supreme Court rejected this argument both as a matter of law and fact. As a matter of law, the court held that there was conscience protections, which would ensure that the doctors wouldn't personally have to face the situation in the future. As a matter of fact, the court walked through the doctors' declarations and concluded that they didn't have any examples of situations in the past when they faced these experiences, and so they hadn't shown a sufficient likelihood that they'd have to face these situations in the future. The plaintiffs also argued that there was a conscience violation that they'd experience if they essentially were aware of other doctors performing abortions, prescribing mifepristone, treating complications. The court held that that type of conscience injury didn't give rise to standing. In other words, it's one thing to say it's an injury to my conscience if I have to provide medical care, but it's another to say my conscience is injured if I just witness other people doing things that I don't agree with. That's not enough for standing, the court held. The second theory of standing was simply that there was a risk that the plaintiffs would just have to take care of these patients in the future. And if they did that, they would spend time on that. They'd rather spend time on other things, and that was an injury. And the court held, both as a matter of fact and law, that this didn't establish standing. As a matter of fact, it was too speculative. There was no real evidence that this was going to happen. And as a matter of law, it would really open the courthouse door for doctors to be able to challenge essentially any rule eliminating safety restrictions. So if a rule on gun safety were relaxed or a speed limit were increased, doctors could sue and say, well, you know, there's going to be more people in the emergency room. We'll have to see them. So we're going to spend time on that. And the court basically wasn't willing to open up the courthouse doors in quite that way. And the final theory of standing that the plaintiffs proffered was organizational standing, essentially saying that the organization themselves would be injured, basically because they'd have to spend time educating people or, you know, combating the rule or advocating against it. And that would expend resources. And, you know, if the rule didn't exist, they wouldn't have to do that. As the court pointed out, that would basically obliterate all limits on standing, because any time any agency passes a rule on anything, an organization can say, well, we're spending money advocating against it, and so that's an injury, and we'd rather spend the money on other things. And, you know, that limitless principle would essentially allow, as I said, any organization to sue any agency over anything. And the court decided that that expanded standing too far. So I'll just say one word about, you know, about my views on the decision. I agree that I view it as a victory for the separation of powers and judicial restraint. The plaintiffs' theories of standing would really broaden the category of agency actions that would be challenged by private plaintiffs. I think that the premise of Article 3 is that the role of the courts is to address legitimate grievances by people who have rules that personally affect them. But when plaintiffs basically disagree as citizens, as opposed to individual litigants, the correct remedy is the political process and not litigation. And that, I think, is the principle that was vindicated by the court in this case. And so I'll turn it over to my colleague now.
Megan, please respond or give us your views of the case.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate Adam's discussion of what the opinion said. I don't really intend to add to that. He's ably covered everything that it was addressing. In this case, I filed an amicus brief on behalf of the Catholic Association, along with a doctor, Dr. Gracie Pozzo Christi, who is a practicing physician in diagnostic radiology. So she reads ultrasounds, which would be the most direct relevance to this case. And I wanted to say a little bit more about the purpose of that amicus brief and the information that it was conveying, in part because I think it's going to continue to be relevant in potentially the further litigation of this case, but also another case that exists in the lower courts in the Ninth Circuit, in which states are challenging these same mifepristone regulations. And that obviously changes the standing calculation, something we can talk a little bit more about. But for purposes of our amicus brief, the goal of the brief was to convey two different things, some additional factual background that was echoing and supportive of what the plaintiffs in this case were arguing. And the first was the medical background about how the deregulation of mifepristone could lead to, and not could, but does lead to more emergency room visits from women who have taken the drug and are experiencing incomplete abortions. So mifepristone is a drug that a woman takes, usually in a two-drug cocktail. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but for simplicity's sake, a woman takes the drug and it causes the body to expel a pregnancy. And that process becomes increasingly risky as a pregnancy progresses. So mifepristone is supposed to be taken before 70 days of gestation. So when a woman's been pregnant for roughly 2 months, and the best way to date a pregnancy, in fact, the only effective and accurate way to know the date of a pregnancy, to know how far along a woman is through an in-person ultrasound. But the FDA's deregulation of mifepristone did away with the requirement of an in-person visit before mifepristone could be administered. And so the result of that is a greatly increased risk that women are self-assessing their pregnancies incorrectly, or with the help of a doctor, their pregnancies are being assessed incorrectly and improperly dated, causing them to take mifepristone much later than 70 days gestation, at which point the risks increase quite significantly. The risk being that the abortion might be initiated, but it wouldn't be completed, and that would necessarily require treatment in an emergency room. And in fact, FDA's package insert on mifepristone says that emergency room care is the backstop for when these drugs fail to complete the abortion, which is expected in a certain percentage of cases. It's also important that women do experience ectopic pregnancies, which are non-viable pregnancies located in the fallopian tube rather than the uterus. And those can only be diagnosed through an in-person ultrasound as well. There are no questions you can ask a woman. There are no, you know, home pregnancy tests that can tell you whether a pregnancy is ectopic. And taking mifepristone in the case of an ectopic pregnancy can be very risky as well and result in the necessity of emergency room care and other complications. So for this reason, our brief was trying to elucidate further some of the factual circumstances at issue here, that the FDA's deregulation of mifepristone by doing away with the requirement of an in-person diagnostic visit would increase the number of emergency room visits and complications that women face. Then the second portion of the brief was really focused on Catholic hospitals. First of all, the very high percentage of hospitals in the United States that are Catholic hospitals, and some of the historical background for why that is. And these hospitals do have conscience concerns when it comes to treating women in these emergency circumstances. To be clear, Catholic hospitals will always treat women who present in an emergency, regardless of whether they've taken mifepristone, regardless of how they come to be in that emergency medical situation. The concern, though, of Catholic hospitals is that there can be very fraught moral circumstances at issue. For example, a woman may come in wanting to complete the abortion, but with a living unborn child. And this would create a serious moral complication for Catholic hospitals. And also in the heat of an emergency, some of these details may not be clear. So this was the second portion of the brief was elucidating some of the conscience problems that would arise for Catholic hospitals. Now, there were no Catholic hospitals as named plaintiffs in the case. And as with all amicus briefs, we're not able to actually supplement the factual record. This was just some additional information. I don't read the court's opinion, and I think they're pretty explicit in not addressing these kinds of the kind of medical evidence or weighing that evidence in the case, which makes perfect sense. You don't have a plaintiff with standing, so of course you wouldn't engage in the merits of the dispute. But what the court's opinion focused on was the connection between these plaintiffs and these alleged injuries. And I think it did a number of important things. I think affirming that the federal law provides conscience protections and that doctors can invoke them simply by refusing to perform medical care that violates their conscience is a helpful elaboration by the court. It wasn't entirely clear how those conscience protections would apply or how EMTALA, another statute at issue in another case before the court right now, would affect conscience protections. And so the court did elaborate on those things, and I think very helpfully for people who have conscience objections to performing abortions. But for that reason, these plaintiffs couldn't assert those conscience objections because they were already protected by federal law. I think the focus of the court's opinion was on the attenuation and the speculative nature of these injuries, some of which I was just discussing about the increase in emergency room visits. the attenuation between that connection and these plaintiffs, that they were unable to substantiate that they had been seeing these increased numbers or that they had been required to perform these additional procedures in an emergency. So I don't think that the court's decision is altogether surprising. I think it is an application of existing standing doctrines, and the court was confronted with some very difficult questions that if these plaintiffs had standing, it would be like giving a blanket doctor-created standing to challenge any public health regulation, for example. And that's this type of generalized grievance that the court does not recognize as conveying standing. And instead, that the Constitution provides political avenues for complaints like those of the plaintiffs, that they can petition Congress and the president to legislatively change things. They can petition the FDA through the appropriate channels to re-regulate or otherwise change this regulation of mifepristone or challenge it in the first instance. And those are the types of relief that these plaintiffs have not through the courts and through Article III standing.
Megan, is it also true, though, that at least in one of the declarations filed by one of the physicians, that while she herself had not encountered a woman coming into the emergency room who still had a live pregnancy, one of her partners had, where the child, they detected the heartbeat, and the doctor felt in order to stop the hemorrhaging that was caused by the mifepristone, that the only way to do that successfully was to terminate the pregnancy. Could you explain to the listeners why that wasn't adequate, given the nature of your brief?
That's right. I believe that was Dr. Francis who did have an her declaration, a description of what she had witnessed or was aware of happening to a partner, exactly as you describe it. And I think had that circumstance happened to Dr. Francis, the court may have reached a different decision, or Dr. Francis herself may have had standing. But because that hadn't happened to her, it almost in some ways confirms the fact that in many hospital settings, there are other doctors who can and are willing to perform these procedures. And so if one doctor has a conscience objection, there's someone else who can take over. Or perhaps if these things happened so infrequently that it wasn't likely that this would happen again, it had never happened to Dr. Francis previously. I think that attenuation analysis is what caused that aspect of Dr. Francis's declaration to not be enough to confer standing.
And Adam, I had a friend ask me a question when I was telling them about this program and encouraging them to watch it. And the question was, how is it that we have, you know, this plethora of cases where doctors providing abortion have been granted standing, third-party standing based on allegations of their patients, and these particular doctors don't have third-party standing? Why didn't these doctors fall into a similar exception to the general rule of third-party standing?
Well, I think the difference is that so it's true that many laws, abortion laws, essentially say that if a doctor performs an abortion, the doctor will face certain criminal or civil consequences. And so in those cases, the doctors are directly harmed by the state action in the sense that, like, their actions are regulated. So the classic situation in which a plaintiff has standing is when there's a regulation that's targeting them. Like, you do something, you go to jail. So obviously the going to jail is an injury that affects the person that's caused by the government, if it's the criminal law that's putting them in jail. And so they have standing to challenge it. They say, I don't want to go to jail. And so I'm harmed by your law that would put me there. Now, the third party standing in those cases stems from the fact that the constitutional violation is really experienced by the women. In other words, the argument is, I don't want to go to jail, and my merits claim is that the constitutional rights of the woman who would be getting the abortion would be violated. But standing is just premised on the direct injury of, you know, sort of facing a criminal trial. The doctors in this case were not targeted by the regulation. The FDA wasn't saying, hey, doctors, you're going to go to jail unless you do something you don't want to do. The doctors were really complaining about the collateral effects of other doctors doing things that were legal under the FDA's rules. And so that's the difference between those two fact patterns.
And I think Justice Gorsuch in writing the, I'm sorry, Justice Kavanaugh in writing the opinion addressed that directly by saying that they were not compelled to do anything. Although, as Megan noted, the Idaho case that will be decided this term also raises the question about what sorts of treatments might be required. Do you have any predictions on that, either of you? Megan?
It's famously difficult to read the tea leaves and predict what the court is going to do in any particular case. I am on the briefs in that case, so I do, I'm following it very closely. And it obviously makes sense that it's going to go down to one of the last days of the term. It was a very important and significant case argued in the last week of arguments at the court. So in that sense, I'm not surprised that we're still waiting. And, you know, I think it's just difficult to say. It's really difficult to predict. I'm optimistic that the court will say that EMTALA doesn't preempt Idaho's laws, but because this case was also arising in sort of an emergency posture, there will be more factual development in the lower courts. And so I also think there might be some factual issues that the court allows the lower courts to contend with. So that's another one of these problems with predicting the outcome of decisions is not only is it difficult to predict which way the decision goes, but because of all the different ways it can be written and the complicating factors, sometimes there aren't clear wins and losses. So I think based on oral argument, I am optimistic that Idaho's law will not be preempted by EMTALA, but I also think that there might be more life to the case, and so there's going to be continued litigation about it. But again, famously difficult to predict, and I don't want to be out on a limb doing that. Maybe Adam feels otherwise.
I don't feel otherwise. a prediction of, with any educate. I mean, there's some, at oral argument, I think there's some back and forth about exactly what it is that Idaho's banned that EMTALA would be legal. There is like some confusion in the record of exactly what the gap was between EMTALA and Idaho law, and maybe that's going to be worked out in the opinions. I don't know. I don't really have any educated guess.
You don't think Justice Kavanaugh gave us any hints in the FDA opinion?
You know, I mean, one can infer from that anything. I don't know. he did quote the oral argument transcript in that case, but I find it very hard to those tea leaves are pretty vague in my opinion.
Yeah, I think, just as Kavanaugh noted that EMTALA would only apply to hospitals, so not to individual doctors. And I think that was a point that he could make without conveying what the likely outcome of the EMTALA case is. So I agree. I don't think it really gives us any better grounds for predicting than we had before this decision came out.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental power is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.